Let me start by just disclosing funding sources for this area of work of ours. We have some funding from the VA, from VU, from NIA, from the National Operating Committee on Standards for Athletic Equipment. And some of you probably heard the tobacco industry, the NFL, gave us an unrestricted gift of a lot of money. And it's an unrestricted gift. It's really one of these things that we made sure all the lawyers were involved. They have no say over what we do in any way, shape, or form. It's just to help our research move forward. And I can honestly say that in spite of all the money that's involved for the NFL and all the politics you hear, the leadership of the NFL has actually been very supportive of what we're doing and concerned about the health of not just those wealthy pros, but also our youth who play all kinds. I want to start by first acknowledging the other three co-directors of our center who really are the stars of this thing. I just get to hang out and give lectures on. But these are the people who really make all the important stuff happen. Bob Cantu is professor of neurosurgery here at BU, but he's also the chair of surgery at Emerson Hospital and the chief of neurosurgery there. He's a very, very, very well-known neurosurgeon in the world. If you hear about the grading systems for concussion, it's the Cantu grading system for concussion. And so he's pretty much written the book on concussion, especially sports concussion, and he's written all of the return to play guidelines internationally for when it is appropriate for athletes to return to activity. Ann McKee, some of you may know, is here at BU. She's a neuropathologist. She and I have been colleagues for a number of years. Is that she runs the neuropathology section of our Alzheimer's Disease Center. I run the clinical research arm of our Alzheimer's Disease Center. And Anne has had an interest not just in neurodegenerative diseases as a neuropathologist for the last 25, 30 years, but specifically in a protein called tau. You're going to hear more about that as I talk. Anne is really the person responsible for all of the findings having to do with deceased athletes and military and other people who we've been studying as really the neuropathologist par excellence. Then there's this guy. Some of you might see him every so often walking through the halls. He's up with us on the seventh floor. His name is Chris Nowinski. Chris was a Harvard football player. He was an all-Ivy lineman. He actually was pretty smart. Graduated cum laude from Harvard, but he got his head hit a whole bunch of times playing football, a lot of times. But I'm not sure if that played a role in his decision for his post-college career, which was to join the WWE, the World Wrestling Entertainment. I've got to tell you a secret. It's choreographed. I'm so sorry to have to break that to you. It's choreographed, but there's only one problem. These are 290 pounders who smack chairs on each other's heads and fall on each other at great heights from the top of the rails or whatever they're called, the ropes. And sometimes the choreography doesn't work that great, and they actually get hurt. They get hurt badly. And he got hurt a lot of times, quite badly, and had to retire because he was having things like would have night terrors, couldn't sleep, he had headaches constantly, he had depression, he had incredibly awful short-term memory. He was really a basket case. He had to retire from his pro wrestling, and he went from doctor to doctor saying, "Help, what's going on with me?" And they'd usually pass it off as depression or whatever. No one, until he saw Dr. Cantu, said, "You have something related to all those hits to your head." And he finally did see Dr. Cantu, who said, "You have post-concussion syndrome, Chris. You hit your head way too many times, and it didn't have a chance to rest and recover. And those symptoms that you're having are due to the hits you've gotten in football and in the WWE." He said, "What? I went to Harvard, I'm a professional athlete, and no one ever told me that I'd actually have these problems if I hurt my head too many times?" He decided at that point that he was going to make it his life mission to change the world of sport and to hopefully solve what he referred to as the concussion crisis in his book called Head Games. That is a super book, if any of you want to read. Chris has been the one person in the world, seriously, who has made the difference in the world of sports and head trauma. So, you know, you hear it all the time now. You hear people talk about concussion, the water cooler, the front page of the paper, you know, every sporting event, you hear people talk about it. There's one person responsible for that, and that's Chris. This is going to be a very graphic talk today. Perfect. To watch us. You know, I show this to current and retired football players, NFL players. And you know how you all went, oh, they go, ah! They actually have the worst response seeing this of any group I speak to. You know how old they are?
Six.
They are 6 years old. We know concussion here a little bit, but if I ask each of you to give me a definition of concussion, you'd each give me a different definition. Because that's just the nature of it. It has been a moving target for the last many, many decades. Let me try to describe from the current point of view what a concussion is. You saw the little brain guy move initially. We all know that when you hit the head in any way, shape, or form, it's going to move around inside the CSF, and it's going to perhaps hit the skull. But I'm not concerned that much about the hitting of the skull. I'm concerned about the acceleration, deceleration forces, the rotational forces that then disturb axonal functioning. And what happens is there's this incredible metabolic cascade when those axons get stretched that changes the membrane potentials. And you have this incredible efflux of calcium, other incredible changes. And during that time, when there is this metabolic crisis, those cells are not going to be functioning right. And that's what causes the symptoms of concussion. And because there's this incredible unbalance across the cell membrane, it requires tremendous amount of energy and metabolic activity to neutralize it, to bring it back, to pump the chemicals in the right direction again. And if you're using energy to do other things, like text message, watch TV, take a test, see a patient, let alone exercise and go back on the field that you may have gotten concussed again. If you expend energy, it's taking away the valuable energy that is required to stabilize the neurons. That make sense? This thing does nothing. Does absolutely nothing to protect the brain inside the skull, surrounded by cerebrospinal fluid. All the helmet was designed to do was to prevent skull fractures. Now there are new helmets that are just being designed in the last couple of years that have these things that are almost like shock absorbers in it that absorb G-force, maybe, if they're good, up to 50% of the actual G-force that the brain is going to then withstand. But the helmet doesn't really do much. The regular helmet that almost everyone wears does nothing to protect against concussion. And so what a concussion is the temporary change in functioning of brain cells caused by the head being struck by a mechanical force to the head that causes the neurons to temporarily stop functioning. It's a non-structural injury. You can't see it on imaging. And with appropriate recovery and rest, those neurons go back to normal. Symptoms, you all know these things. But people aren't aware, no matter who I'm talking to, is that things like dings, getting your bell rung, seeing stars, those are concussions. And so, at least in my generation, We all saw stars all the time and got dinged and went back and played things and whatever. Oh, it's just a ding. It's not a concussion. It is. And without that rest, what can happen is a prolongation of those symptoms, resulting in post-concussion syndrome. So you have depression, headaches, feeling in a fog, poor concentration, difficulty with memory that lasts for months and months, perhaps. But it gets better. Okay? It's not a forever thing. Then what about something called subconcussive blows, which we refer to as impact to the brain with adequate G-force to cause some a kind of metabolic crisis, but without symptoms. Concussion is when you have a force to the brain that then results in symptoms. But there's a lot of times the head gets hit with no immediate symptoms. If you think of some positions in football, as an example, like a lineman, every play of every game of every practice, they're hitting their head. That's 1,000 to 1,500 head strikes a year. I don't think our brains were created to take 1,000 to 1,500 hits to the brain. There was a study by Purdue University looking at kids, high school students, where they fit their helmets with these accelerometers to measure the amount of G-force. And they were carefully studying these kids to make sure that they didn't have concussion, or if they did have concussion, they were quickly diagnosed and they'd be resting until they had no more symptoms. Prior to the season, they all had this thing called impact testing, which is a computerized neuropsych type of assessment that's used now ubiquitously across all different high school, professional, college sports. But they also had fMRI. So they were able to measure basically the physiological functioning of the brain. Before the season, they measure their cognitive functioning before the season. They then get the helmets. And what they found was striking, that the kids who did not have a symptomatic concussion, but who had a huge amount of G over and over again, these subconcussive hits, actually had worse outcomes on fMRI and cognitive assessment than the kids who had diagnosed concussions. Possibly. Conjecture, but it makes sense to me. Because they went back to play over and over again. So, I want you to forget about concussions and post-concussion syndrome, all that kind of stuff. That's not why I'm here. This is a geriatric section. I'm here to talk about neurodegenerative disease, a disease that will progress as we age. And you'll see how they connect. Because there may be some long-term consequences of repeated concussions and subconcussive blows. So in other words, after the initial symptoms go away of either the concussions or the post-concussion syndrome in the people who have it, after those things clear, in some people, a progressive neurodegenerative disease begins and continues to get worse. Who's this? Who said that? You get extra points. Yeah, it's before he changes it. We know what he looks like now, right? Imagine in your head. He's not doing too well. He has what's called dementia pugilistica, the dementia of pugilists. It was first described in Boxers in 1928 by Martland in JAMA. This is my favorite JAMA article of all time, because in it, these are the clinical words to describe this syndrome called von Strunk. Goofy, slug nutty, cuckoo, in JAMA. It was originally referred to as punch drunk in 1928. Then in 1937, the term dementia pugilistica was first used. It wasn't, though, until 1973 that Corsellis looked at a series of deceased boxer brains and described the initial neuropathology of dementia pugilistica and showed that it was indeed, as far as they could tell in 1973, a distinct disease. And so for our future use now. The term dementia pugilistica is the exact same thing as chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. Okay? Same thing, there's no difference. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to refer to CTE. And what is it? It's a progressive neurodegenerative disease that is similar to Alzheimer's in several respects, but wholly unique. It's similar in that you all know that if you watch someone progress, no matter what the etiology of their dementia is, most dementias clinically look the same later on in the course of the dementia. It's also similar in that, as I'll show you in a few minutes, they share a certain neuropathological problem. They're both tauopathies. They both have an abundance of tau. But Alzheimer's has another protein that you're all probably familiar with, and that's beta amyloid, whereas CTE doesn't. So CTE is believed to be caused by repetitive blows to the head, okay? Including concussions, and this is the scary part, subconcussive hits. It is not prolonged post-concussion syndrome. It's a separate entity that starts, you'll see, early. You don't know exactly when. Just like these other neurodegenerative diseases, they start at an early age neuropathologically and then continue to get worse, and once it's bad enough, the symptoms begin. And in this case, the symptoms begin years or decades after the person stopped hitting their heads. It can only be diagnosed neuropathologically postmortem. And Anne is the person in the world who has seen more CTE than any other neuropathologist. The brain bank that she runs is over at the Bedford VA. So this is CTE. These are hemispheric slices that are not microscopically enhanced. These are just very thin slices that are, these are actual just photo scans. And they are immunostained for tau. Everything that's brown is stained for tau. Just to orient you a little bit, this is the medial temporal lobe, amygdala, hippocampus, frontal lobe. You're going to see this picture in many different cases as I move along, and I'll describe what you're seeing. So what is the neuropathologic presentation of CTE? Well, it's an abundance of an abnormal hyperphosphorylated form of tau in the form of neurofibrillary tangles, as well as neuropil threads and a whole lot of glial involvement, glial tangles. There's a widespread distribution across the entire brain, both white matter and gray matter. But initially, we see it in the frontal lobes, especially orbitofrontal lobes, and the medial temporal lobes, especially the amygdala, more than the hippocampus. Well, especially the fellows here who've heard me talk about a bunch of this kind of stuff, you can imagine the awful combination of behavioral ramifications. If you hurt the area of the brain that's responsible for controlling behavior, putting a lid on it, and you hurt the part of the brain, there it is, cover it. If you hurt the part of the brain that is responsible for emotion and where drive and rage come, you have a lousy combination. Just to give you an idea of what Anne sees, early on we see this perivascular deposition of the tau. So the white thing in the middle is a blood vessel. And so the earliest thing we see is this perivascular tau, and especially neurofibrillary tangles. This is just more microscopic. We also see it in the superficial layers of the cortex. Just to give you an idea of the difference between Alzheimer's disease and CTE. On the top is a normal brain, where you have no amyloid, no tau. In the middle is CTE, where you have no amyloid. And the tau that you see is very superficial. Microscopically, more enhanced, these are all huge neurofibrillary tangles, but you see no amyloid plaques. If we do see some plaques in some cases, it's not the Alzheimer's senile plaque that we would typically see in Alzheimer's disease. And on the bottom, this is both tau and amyloid. But if you notice where the tau is, it's much deeper in the cortex, deeper layers, where virtually nothing, where we see the tau in CTE. And here you see the huge amyloid plaques as well as the what I want to do now is to go through a few cases to make this more human, more real. This was the first case that was donated to our center. John Grimsley. John died at age 45. He was a Pro Bowler, linebacker, played mainly for the Houston Oilers and also for the Dolphins. He had diagnosed 8 concussions, but as a linebacker, he had a whole lot more. Many more real concussions that were never diagnosed because football players especially underreport their symptomatic concussions. But what about all those subconcussive hits as well? And for the 5 years prior to his death, his wife Virginia described him as having an increasingly awful short fuse. Think about that, amygdala and the prefrontal lobe. Depression, but not bad, but just irritability. It wasn't the sad, dysphoric kind of. Really lousy short-term memory. In fact, she really knew there was a problem. When after their son got engaged and was about to have an engagement party, he completely forgot. After his retirement from the NFL, he was a hunting guidesman and a fishing guide. He'd go bring people out, teach them how to hunt and fish and stuff. He knew his way around a gun. One night, unfortunately, he was cleaning his gun without any alcohol or drugs on his system, without any evidence of suicide. He forgot to take out the ammunition because of his memory problem, and he shot himself in the chest accidentally. Here's John's brain, age 45, medial temporal lobe. You can also see the tau depositions very consistently in the depths of the sulci. That's one of our constant features. Just to put it in perspective, on the left is a 65-year-old healthy control. You don't see this tau stuff in any healthy control, even if they live into the hundreds. Anne is the pathologist for our Alzheimer's Disease Center, for the Framingham Heart Study, for Tom's New England Centenarian Study, for the VA regionally, the National VA ALS Brain Bank. She sees thousands and thousands of brains, including very old, healthy brains. You don't see it. Greater perspective, though, is this is another case of ours of a world champion boxer who died at age 73 after a long bout, so to speak, of dementia. Thought to have dementia pugilistica. Very severe case of CTE. But look, 45 years old. Grimsley's case was not that much better. Our second case was that of Tom McHale. Tom also died at age 45. He was a 9-year veteran lineman, played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, very smart guy, graduated from Cornell. After he retired, he was a very well-known restaurateur in the Tampa Bay area. Husband and father of 3 boys. No reported concussions. Lisa, his wife, knew him since the Cornell days, and he never had a single reported concussion, never complained to her about any symptoms at all. But he was a lineman his entire life, pretty much. His last few years of life, he had an absolutely awful time with substance abuse. That was not the typical substance abuse story. He was out of control. He so wanted to change. Personality changed, his ability to deal with rehab didn't work, he was out of control, and one day he died from a drug overdose. He's 45 years old. It's not just the pros. This isn't just a disease of professional football players. This was our first college football case. Mike Borich, he died at age 42. He played Division I football. He then went on to be a college coach. He had, during his football playing years, he had at least 10 concussions, probably many more, nothing since his football days. He was an award-winning Division I college coach. He then also coached for the Chicago Bears for a year. But he had to leave coaching in 2003 because he could not control himself. Overwhelming substance abuse, alcohol abuse. Beginning at the age of 38, he developed these increasing problems with irritability, agitation, violent outbursts. He died of a drug overdose in February 2009, and here's his brain. It's not just football. This was our first professional hockey player, Reg Fleming. Some of you who were from the Boston area years ago might remember Reg, or if you're a hockey fan. Reg died at age 73 from dementia. He was a defenseman and forward for six different teams for many, many years. Everyone know what an enforcer is in hockey? They're the ones who are the fighters. He was the original enforcer. He's the one who started the role of enforcer. He had at least 20 concussions playing hockey, two of which led to loss of consciousness. He had symptoms of CTE for decades. I interview all the family members in depth of all these brains we get. And I was struck by the story for Reg Fleming, because when they look back and told me the story, he was actually diagnosed by one psychiatrist as being manic depressive because he was out of control. Could not control his behaviors, emotions. And so they brought him to someone and they said, well, I don't know what's really going on. I think he must be manic depressive. He wasn't. Starting in his 40s, he had this extreme behavioral discontrol. And then not until his final 2 years of life, at age around 70, 71, he developed a full-blown dementia and had to be institutionalized. That's his brain. It starts early. Some of you may have read in the paper and the media a few months ago of this guy, Owen Thomas. He hanged himself exactly 1 year ago in his UPenn apartment. He had just been unanimously voted the co-captain of the UPenn football team. He'd been a lineman since forever, football player since he was 9 years old. Both of his parents, seen on the bottom right, are ministers. They had a great relationship with him. They knew him well. He never had any reported symptoms of concussion throughout that entire time. He also had no depression. He was concerned right at the time of finals that he wasn't doing as well as his stellar past. He was a Wharton School student. He was fantastic. He was beloved by everyone. And then one night, out of the blue, without a note, without anything, he hanged himself. 21. Now, did this cause his suicide? No idea. Unlikely. It may have, but unlikely. More importantly, what this showed us was that looking at a brain of a 21-year-old, we already see the disease starting. Looking at the brain of someone who had played from 9 years to 21 years, who never had a reported symptomatic concussion, we're still seeing it. And if he had lived, because of the progressive nature of the disease, this would have gotten more and more extensive. Now, these are just a few slices. There were 20 to 30 of these lesions in his brain. We've seen it even younger. Here's an 18-year-old. He was a multi-sport athlete in high school who died of unrelated causes. 18. We've now seen it in 17. Wally Hilgenberg died at age 66 from Lou Gehrig's disease, from ALS. He was an incredibly aggressive linebacker. 16 years in the pros. At least 10 concussions and multiple cervical spine injuries. One day, he was running full force. This was before people hit their heads against heads, okay?
Because he wore leather helmets for the beginning of this. People didn't hit heads. But he went full force into the chest of his opponent. He didn't know that his opponent had a full cast. He lost consciousness for a long time. And this was right at the beginning of the days of television on the NFL. The camera's still rolling. He's out. There's gasps through the stadium. It was that injury that began that whole thing now in televised sports where they never keep the camera going. They go to a commercial break. Anyways, at age 56, I get the story of a slow and steady cognitive decline, including a tremendous executive dysfunction. This was from his son who shared a business with him. He had just awful planning, organization, multitasking. His memory was not very good, and he had this profound apathy. He just didn't care about anything. Then, at age 64, he started tripping, started having fasciculations, did hyperreflexia, went to two very, very important medical centers around the country, each independently diagnosed him with ALS. He died 2 years later with both cognitive impairment and motor neuron disease, as well as profound. Here's his brain. No A-beta, just the typical, as you've seen now over and over again, presentation of this tauopathy. Now, one thing I didn't tell you is that it's not just the brain in some people, not in many, but in these cases where we have seen now several people with motor neuron disease, the spinal cord and the brainstem, especially the spinal cord, also has the tau deposition. But I also haven't told you that now we've seen that it's not just tau in this disease, it's also TDP43, another protein that is involved with several other types of disorders, including some types of frontotemporal dementia and some forms of ALS, motor neuron disease. And in all of our cases now, we've seen TDP43. So it's actually a tauopathy and a TDP43 prognopathy. But it's only in a small fraction of cases where we see the TDP43 and the tau in both the brain and the spinal cord. And in those cases, these people have died of ALS. We call it chronic traumatic encephalomyelopathy. So it's a disease that's never been described before. That doesn't mean that Lou Gehrig didn't have Lou Gehrig's disease. Number one, he was cremated. We don't know. But number two, clinically, all of these motor neuron diseases really look the same, and someone's going to be clinically diagnosed appropriately as having ALS. There's many different causes of motor neuron disease, neuropathologically and mechanistically, pathophysiologically. This seems to be one of them. In fact, when you look at football players, pro football players, the number of football players who have died of ALS is 8 to 13 times greater than same-age males in this country. The military have a huge preponderance of deaths from ALS. All right, let's go on. So we have around 80 brains now in our VACSTE brain bank. We've completed the examinations both neuropathologically and clinical post-mortem kind of interviews and medical records of 40 confirmed cases. And so what I'd like to do is to just share with you our experience of the clinical presentation of CTE. The ages so far are between 17 and 80s.
across multiple different types of sports, all different levels of play, and now the military as well, from people who have died after they had exposure to repetitive blast injuries. There have been several cases, as you've already heard of some, of suicide and suicide-like behavior. Several cases of substance abuse and other addictions, from gambling to sex to food to whatever. Early on, the key features involve impulse control problems, short fuse, the sense of being out of control, irritability and agitation, depression, suicidality, apathy, and memory difficulties. Key features later in the course of the disease are a worsening memory, but it's not the hippocampal episodic memory problem that you see in Alzheimer's disease necessarily. It's not the rapid forgetting of information. It's more of an executive kind of memory problem where it's more difficulty freely recalling information. And then related to that is more executive impairment as well as spatial impairment and then motor impairment, not just that CTEM, not just the motor neuron disease, but also like what you see in Muhammad Ali, Parkinsonism, poor speech, ataxia, very commonly poor balance, and falling. And then some develop this ALS-like disease as well. And then eventually, if people live long enough, dementia. But I'm not talking about living until necessarily old age. But I'm not talking about showing the symptoms of dementia at the age that we would normally see in sporadic Alzheimer's disease. I'm talking about people who start becoming demented in their 50s. Where those earlier symptoms start in 30s and 40s. It's a very slow disease process. So that's all we know. In other words, we know virtually nothing except what I've just told you. We have no idea how common it is. Currently, of the cases we've completed and published about, we have 13 out of 14 NFL players who have had CTE. It's a very biased sample. We can't make any reference extrapolate to real prevalence and incidence from a very biased postmortem kind of study. But what's the denominator? What if the next 86 cases come into us and they're all clean? Well, I wish I could tell you that that's the case. We have actually several more than those 13 or 14. We haven't published, so I don't talk about. They're coming in positive. But let's say they were all clean. That's still potentially 13% of 13 out of 100. We definitely need to understand that in longitudinal research with larger sample sizes, and not just studying football, pro football players. One of the biggest questions we have to answer, though, is why do some people get it and some people not get it? In other words, what we believe is that repetitive blows to the head are a necessary ingredient to develop CTE, but not sufficient. Not everyone who has a history of repetitive blows will get the disease. What we'd like to find out is, what is that magic combination of the types of hits? Is it the severity of the hits? Like, do you need to have had at least one episode of loss of consciousness? I don't think so. But we need to find out. Is it grades of concussion? Those were the things when we first started out, we didn't really think about subconcussive blows. We thought this was just related to concussions. But now we're realizing more and more that it's those milder things in some way that can also lead to the disease. What about the age of exposure? Is there this magic threshold that, you know, if you're 9 years old and you start getting hit, that's going to increase your risk if, compared to someone who's 20 who starts getting hit? We have no idea. So we can't make any recommendations, don't do this activity until you're such and such age, because we just don't know. What about the overall duration of the exposure? Is it, you need to have more than a year, you need to have more than 10 years, we don't know. What about the frequency and the time interval between the hits? Is it related to that lack of recovery, That's one of our current working hypotheses, that mechanistically there seems to be something about that initial impact to the neurons and the breakdown of the cell membrane that creates this whole cascade of events that leads to caspases and caspanes and the initial development of a tau deposition that then cycles on itself and then in years starts to create this deposition of neurofibrillary tangles. We just don't know for sure yet. One of the biggest questions that need to be answered quickly is how can we detect it and diagnose it during life? We've been wanting to know that for 106 years now in Alzheimer's. But as many of you know, just in the last couple of years, we're getting closer to that. Actually, pretty darn close. Where there are methods now of being able to have a signature biomarker diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease during life. It's not 100%, but it's pretty darn close. But unless we can diagnose and detect it early and detect it in life, we can't do things like try to figure out how to treat it. We don't know what we're treating. What's happened over the last 2.5 years is that there has been this whopping media attention and culture change. The problem is science doesn't work that quickly. I had a complete full head of hair when we started. There's so much to do, and so not even just little time. There's no money. The budget that was finally approved yesterday actually is not that bad for NIH. It's only a little bit of a decline from last year's absolutely awful, horrendous funding. So what we're trying to do to answer some of these questions is to do some type of non-pathologic examinations. One thing is I'm running a large brain donation registry where we currently have 400 people already examined. We have another 900 people waiting to get into it. We don't know where we're going to stop. And what it is it's pro and amateur athletes of all sports, all different levels, as long as you played some kind of organized sport. Swimming, tennis, you name it. Male, female. And now we actually have a separate registry that we're starting hopefully this week on with military. Doesn't matter if there's any history of brain trauma. What we're trying to do is get this real diverse set of variables that we can eventually be able to look at what are the risk factors. All these people agree to donate their brains and spinal cords after they die. And they all undergo an annual telephone-based interview. That's how we can do so many. It's that it's all based on the telephone. But we do objective telephone cognitive assessments with computerized recordings doing reaction times and all kinds of neat things. But we also get a whole lot of behavioral and psychiatric measures, as well as medical history, sports history, military history, all that kind of stuff. And we're now getting spit. Saliva samples from everyone so we can measure ApoE and bank DNA for future genetic. One of our latest, very popular guys who is part of our registry is Mickey Ward, from the Focus of the Fighter. But we can't wait for all those people to die and look at their brains. We need to be able to diagnose and detect it now. So one thing we're starting very soon is a whole series of things that we can hopefully try to come up with some biomarkers of the disease while people are alive. One of the things we've already done is we've done some pilot neuroimaging studies with some colleagues of mine at the Brigham. This is, I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. This is just a 3D MRI where on the left is a former football player, NFL player, who was in middle age and symptomatic, likely to be someone at risk for CTE and that his symptoms may have CTE, but we don't know for sure. And here's this age, gender match control, size match control. You don't need to be a radiologist to see the incredible atrophy in the frontal and parietal and temporal lobes of our athlete. This is diffusion tensor imaging, which is able to do incredible things to look at actual fiber tracks. Those are honest-to-goodness neuronal fiber tracks coming from the corpus callosum. Another former NFL player and control subject. And what you see is this diminution of the fiber tracks. Those are axons. Another thing we're doing is magnetic resonance spectroscopy. We have some really cool findings already in just a small number of holes where we're able to have these differences in biochemical metabolites in the brain that match our underlying hypotheses about what's going on in the brain. And so what we're doing soon is we're starting a large study of NFL, former NFL players, hopefully 150, with the highest exposure to repetitive trauma, meaning players who play at linebacker, many, many years worth of exposure, compared to some other athletes who had no history of repetitive trauma. Then we're doing a whole bunch of neuroimaging, including the ones I just told you, plus some others. We're going to be doing lumbar punctures to be able to look at proteins, because like in Alzheimer's disease, we can measure A-beta, we can measure tau. The idea with this is that we shouldn't have any change at all in A-beta, but huge elevations of tau. Just the very beginning, though. So with that,